Anyway, well, I didn't have a whole lot of stuff prepared today. Just a few things, maybe. Went through the paper, found this great article. I mean, for all you musicians out there who might be into this sort of thing, I don't know. I am one, and so I am. This is about, well, it says, Guitar on a Smoking Hot Roll. The cigar box instrument's raw simplicity keeps luring musicians to strum to its distinctly low-tech beat. By Randy Lewis. The pages of newspapers, or history books for that matter, don't runneth over with stories of happy accidents involving chainsaws. But that's just what put Philadelphia musicians Lucy Tite and Wayne Waxing, who tour as Hymn for Her, H-Y-M-N, Hymn for Her, in possession of a musical instrument that changed the direction of their career. The incident also brought them into a surprising community that sprung up in the last decade around one of the most primitive tools of the trade, the cigar box guitar, a simple homemade instrument that in decades past has been the first instrument for many blues, folk, and country musicians with great musical passion but little financial means. We were in Memphis, Tennessee, on tour, Tite said, during Hymn for Her's recent swing through Southern California. While one of their cohorts was helping a friend they were staying with cut up some trees that were down during a storm. The chainsaw bucked, hit him in the head, and he ended up in the hospital. As a parting gift, because he felt so bad about the accident, our friend gave us one of his cigar box guitars. It definitely has changed our sound a lot. The particular instrument she's talking about is a Lobo, named after the friend who created it and gave it to them, Memphis-based musician and luthier John Lowe. It consists of a broomstick handle melded to a bona fide cigar box across which run three strings, one bass string for the low-end notes and two guitar strings for rhythm accompaniment and soloing. Plugged into a high-wattage amplifier, it produces the sound of the mythical hellhound on proto-blues man Robert Johnson's Trail. It's one example of a mushrooming number of modern-day versions of the primitive cigar box instruments of yore. Their popularity is growing, not coincidentally, during a technologically sophisticated age of mass-produced instruments that allow players to mimic the sound of virtually any vintage guitar or amplifier ever made. Some cigar box instruments, like Lowe's, remain consciously low-tech, using just one, two, or three strings. Others, often employing four, or sometimes even eight strings, apply sophisticated guitar-making skills, resulting in functional instruments that exemplify artistic mastery of the luthier's craft. And what initially may look like a novelty item good for a laugh at a cocktail party is being taken increasingly seriously by professionals. Mark Ribot, a respected session guitarist who has worked extensively with producer T-Bone Burnett and singer-songwriter Tom Waits, has played one that belongs to Waits on some of the iconoclastic singer-songwriter's recordings. Old-style instruments evoke the recordings which were made using these types of instruments and the world these recordings represent, Ribot said. They're a way for musicians to play, not only with notes, but with history. At first glance, you might not take it seriously, said ZZ Top guitarist Billy Gibbons, until you pick one up and start strumming it. Gibbons quickly became an enthusiast after hearing a band member messing with one in the back of their tour bus after a concert. It's patently amazing what you can do with just two notes. For the most part, people are quite pleasantly surprised to hear what you can get out of one of these. Rock guitar hero Steve Miller, in a separate interview, agreed, "When I saw Billy's, I thought, what a really simple thing to play. Now I have two of them. They're extremely expressive, funky little instruments." With a laugh, he added, "It's probably what Bo Diddley had when he was little." Little Diddley, the name of Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member Bo Diddley, is a hallowed one in the cigar box instrument community. The rectangular-bodied electric guitar with which he pounded out the song and proto-rock beat that carries his name in the 50s was directly modeled on the crude cigar box instruments he and others first learned to play. It was not limited to blues players such as Blind Willie Johnson and Lightnin' Hopkins, but was a tool that rock, country, and jazz greats such as Jimi Hendrix, Carl Perkins, and Charlie Christian played when they were young. In fact, the Mississippi musician born Otha Bates Ellis McDaniel took his nom de stage from the diddly bow, a single string instrument created by wrapping a piece of baling wire around two nails hammered into the side of a house, a barn, or plank of wood. Musical grit. For many musicians, a cigar box guitar embodies purity of musical expression. Musicians like myself, we want that grit, said Shane Spiel, who created the Cigar Box Nation website that now claims about 3,000 members. We want an instrument that kicks our ass. That's what's happening. There's no central musician that's leading the charge. One irony of the cigar box guitar phenomenon is that the first instruments were a byproduct of technological advancements during the Industrial Revolution. For centuries, tobacco had been transported from cellar to buyer as raw leaves in large bundles. When manufacturing techniques improved in the 19th century, facilitating the production of pre-rolled cigars, they started being shipped in more consumer-friendly wood boxes. Once the cigars had been smoked, the boxes were disposed of or repurposed for other uses, including homemade musical instruments for those who didn't even have a few dollars with which to purchase a used one. Modern luthiers with a zest for folk art have been attracted to the challenge cigar box culture presents in making legitimate instruments from homespun materials. In general, what we perceive is a kind of renaissance in guitar making, said Tatiana Sizonenko, curator of the Museum of Making Music in Carlsbad, an arm of the National Association of Music Merchants Trade Organization for musical equipment manufacturers and dealers. I think it's in reaction to the technological development, in a way. In guitar making, the way for many producers to cut the cost of instruments is to ship orders to China, do the machinery there, then ship parts back that they assemble here, Sizonenko said. People look back and say, with all the tools we have, we can make more beautiful handmade instruments. This movement is growing. We're seeing more and more makers every day, and there's more sharing of information on how to make guitars. It's no longer tied to a specific family secret. People share recipes like they do in cooking. He added that the internet has facilitated the growth of many new musical communities. There are ukulele groups, steel guitar groups, vintage guitar groups, slack key guitar groups, accordion groups. In Southern California, there are very active communities of people who, because of social media, now have the possibility of making homegrown musical festivals. Local craftwork. The Southland has its own repository of cigar box makers, including North Hollywood's Matty Barato and Highland Park's Mark Melchior. When he isn't building or repairing conventional guitars for customers such as Kiss, Marilyn Manson, Sugar Ray, Zakk Wylde, and the Goo Goo Dolls, Barato makes a cigar box model he calls the Sig Fiddle, which he'll be showing off Saturday at the Lobo Cigar Box Guitar Festival in Orlando, Florida. I don't think I'll make it. Sig Fiddles sell for $400 to $500 for basic models and come up to $1,500 for combinations that come with one of Barato's equally down-to-earth wine box amplifiers. Melchior has recently built his 50th cigar box guitar out of his residence in Highland Park and sells the instruments mostly by word of mouth. Several are on display at La Luz de Jesus in Los Feliz as part of the gallery's annual Everything But the Kitchen Sink, SYNC, group exhibition that opens Friday and runs through March 27th, which means it's there now. Remember that, folks? La Luz de Jesus in Los Feliz as part of the gallery's annual Everything But the Kitchen Sink group exhibition that opened Friday and runs through March 27th. I've left a footprint in a lot of areas, but this seemed like fertile ground, something with which I could get neck deep into American folk art, said Melchior, who is also a singer and songwriter. It's taken me a lot farther than anything else I've done. This is very pure craftsmanship in an old world way, which is how Melchior has trained was trained in Wisconsin working as an apprentice to Italian-born accordion builder Alfonso Baldoni, which is an accomplishment. Guitar technology is moving into things like self-tuning bridges. But if you can't tune your own guitar, he said, letting the thought finish itself, I've got to grab the reins and do my thing. I feel like a frontiersman, and this is a lot more exciting. Beyond the possibility of that direct connection, for many of the most devoted practitioners, it's about the supremacy of expressivity over technology. At first, I was a little intimidated by it because it requires a lot of lead playing, which I wasn't used to. But once I started messing around with it, I find it more liberating, said musician Tite, who, with Waxing, are recording their latest album, Lucy and Wayne, and the American Stream in their Airstream trailer while touring the country. When everything else gets so technological, with everything that's there to break down, you want to get back to the raw essence of what music is all about, she said. It's definitely a passionate instrument. When you play an instrument that's handmade like this, you feel the passion. And this is a great article because it came with some great pictures of some very beautiful cigar box guitars that do kind of hearken to Bo Diddley. And it says some of Barato's Sig Fiddle guitars, which count Johnny Depp and P.J. Harvey among their enthusiasts, are on display at his North Hollywood shop. Ho ho. Okay, well, keep that name in mind, huh? Matty Barreto. Anyway, on to other things. All right. So, I'll get that out of the way. Get back to this one. Okay, let's try this.
it's got a hold of me. Mission, damn it, please. Mission's got a hold of me. Mission, it's gonna kill me.
exceeding on the level of our unconsciousness. For example, what does the billboard say? Come and play, come and play. Forget about the movement.
So for those of you who may be interested, that was, that was Rage Against the Machine, and before that was Black Flag doing Depressions, Got a Hold of Me, and before that was Supernut, right? Black Flag doing Supernut. So I didn't have a lot else to play here. Let's see here. Get rid of that. All right, I got something all queued up now. And anyway, I was going to just read a couple of little shorty short things here. And it's for your entertainment. Let's see. This is, they never show the date on the paper anymore, huh? I don't know. Well, this is from some newspaper, some daily news. This is Doug McIntyre, waiting for the big one. It's the little things that will get you. I don't trust the things I own. I felt this way once before, exactly 4:31 a.m. on January 17, 1994. I was inexplicably at my desk when the earth rumbled and punched my tiny rented house in North Hollywood, which is now called Toluca Woods, fooling no one. Memories of Northridge were awakened as I found myself once again at my desk when the giant 8.9 magnitude Japanese quake struck. I watched in real time after the earth shook, and as an enormous wall of water swept away everything in its path, including countless lives. The tectonic plates under Southern California are different in character than the subduction plates under Japan, so it's unlikely a great quake here would produce a Japanese-style tsunami, or anything like the tsunami that killed 250,000 in South Asia in 2004. But that doesn't mean we're out of the woods, Tolucan or otherwise. A much smaller quake in Haiti also killed 250,000 due to nearly non-existent building codes and zero enforcement, proving not all government regulations are bad. In quakes, it's our stuff that kills us. Take a look around. It might have seemed like a good idea to hang that mirror over the bed. Sure, it perked up the romance department, but your world may end up being rocked in ways you neither expected nor wanted. In an earthquake, even kinky has to be decoded. When Mother Earth snaps, all the things we buy, collect, hoard, and cherish turn against us. I own a small bust of Theodore Roosevelt that sits on a shelf above my desk, but now I look upon him with suspicion, knowing if given the right jolt, Teddy may once again charge up San Juan Hill, only this time to crush my skull. Same goes for that huge stack of CDs in the corner, the globe I got at the Rose Bowl flea market, and all those bookcases filled with page-turners like A Brief History of Norway and In the Days of McKinley. When the big one hits, furniture, appliances, pictures, and mementos can become projectiles of death. I now fear the wife's teacup collection and look with deep distrust upon my small, unsolicited army of bobblehead dolls. It would be just my luck to be killed by a nodding airborne Kurt Rambis or André Ethier while Los Angeles prays for the victims of this terrible earthquake and tsunami. Now is also the time to take an inventory of our homes for the inevitable next time when the world will be praying for us. Now I had this other little bit of music news for you. Might be of some interest to people involved in music history. This is in the obituaries page, I'm sorry to say. This is the passing of Gene Dinning, writer of the 50s song Teen Angel. Gene Dinning, I'll try and find that if I can, okay? Gene Dinning, 86, who wrote the tragic pop song Teen Angel that became a number one hit for her brother. In 1959, died February 22nd in Garden Grove, said her daughter, Cynthia Weigall. Dinning had a respiratory illness. She wrote the song after reading a newspaper article about teenagers making positive contributions that used the phrase teen angels. Her younger brother, Mark Dinning, recorded the sad ballad, and it was his only major hit. He died of a heart attack at 52 in 1986. The song is credited with inaugurating an early 1960s cycle of morbid songs about teenage mortality that included Ray Peterson's Tell Laura I Love Her and Jan and Dean's Dead Man's Curve. One of nine children, she was born Eugenia Dinning on March 29, 1924 in Enid, Oklahoma. As one of the Dinning sisters, a trio that included her twin Ginger Dinning, she performed from the late 1930s until 1954. The group had a top 10 hit with Buttons and Bows in 1948 and appeared on the country music TV show The National Barn Dance. A mother of five, Dinning was married and divorced twice. Her third husband, Joel Red Beasley, died in 1994. She used to call Teen Angel her guardian angel, her daughter said, because it supported her through her old age. And there's a lovely old tintype picture of her when she was cute. There's no pictures of her when she was 86, so I don't know. Sorry to hear. Here's something, a little public service thing that you might be interested in. Google has launched a person finder. Google Incorporated has launched an online tool that allows users to search for people or provide information about someone who may be missing as a result of the earthquake in Japan. Person Finder, which has been used in previous disasters, is a central database that individuals, governments, and aid agencies can tap to find people and gather information about their condition. The 8.9 magnitude earthquake set off a massive tsunami and may have killed hundreds of people. No, I think it's far more than that. This must be a few days old. Google launched Person Finder after the Haiti earthquake and most recently deployed the tool for the Christchurch earthquake, a 6.3 tremor that struck the New Zealand cities February 22nd. As of midday Friday, more than 7,200 queries had been recorded on Person Finder, which is available in Japanese and English. The tool can be found on Google's Crisis Response webpage, which also includes maps, related news stories, YouTube videos, and other resources such as links to Japanese utilities and government agencies. Jamie Ude, a Google spokesman, said Person Finder for the Japanese earthquake was online about an hour after the earthquake hit. Person Finder was developed by Google's Crisis Response Team, which is made up of employees of the company's philanthropic arm, Google.org. Oh, there's a Google.org. Oh, and we have a phone call.
You've reached the studios of Kill Radio. What can I do for you?
Hey, it's Kill Radio. This is Bennett.
Oh, it's Bennett. All right. You caught me just at the end of an article about Google launching their People Finder.
Keep going. Let me listen.
Oh, I finished up.
I'm sorry.
I got through the last sentence or two just as the phone was ringing. So.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, that's okay. Except, you know, when you're going out over the air, when the phone rings, it doesn't ring. In studio, it rings, but on the air, it goes click, 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 like that. So, I don't know, may have been over the top of a couple of those sentences, but I think I covered the gist of it.
No, you probably this morning I had the phone ring and it didn't get recorded, so.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah, see, you hear it ring in the studio because it's an audible ring, but it doesn't carry to the mic because the electrical interference on the line just sounds like a buzzer or something.
Well, are you playing music or am I on the air now?
Oh, you are on the air now.
Well, hello, Kill Radio audience.
Woo! And I got your email about the meeting tomorrow for all you other Kill Radio aficionados, and I think I'm probably good for a ride, as long as my car is still working.
Is your car doing okay?
And it's still got those grindy brakes. I don't know. I think I'm going to have to replace the drums, too, for as long as I've been driving it like this.
Well, that's not terribly expensive. Oh. Can you do it yourself? Are you good enough to do the drums?
Well, I have a good mechanic.
Okay, there you go.
You know, I trust him more than I trust me.
There you go.
Yeah.
I mean, doing the shoes or something is fairly easy, but the drums kind of difficult. So.
Yeah, I think, you know, the shoes are so far gone that I'm sure the drums need to at least be checked. At least.
Well, you should probably make an appointment and do that then.
Oh, yeah.
Who knows? We might, you know, you might, the car get might get hit by a tsunami or something. And, you know, you want to be able to have brakes when there's a tsunami.
Probably not a lot you could do at that point.
Now, since you're not a television person, you haven't seen the film of the tsunami hitting the shores in Japan?
Oh, I've seen quite a bit online.
Okay, good.
I've seen quite a bit online, yeah, because there's like sites of just series of videos that are...
Yeah, it's devastating. It's devastating to watch it. And my heart goes out to all those people over there. In the town of, I think it's Sendai, that 17,000 people... No, it's not Sendai. Sendai's bigger than that. But a small town of 17,000 people, 10,000 have died.
That's, yeah.
One, in one town.
I mean, just from the devastation, I mean, it makes, you know, it's puts Katrina on a small scale.
Katrina is nothing compared to this.
Oh, the devastation is just, and you know that there were people in there. You know, when you catch that video of all those cars sloshing around and stuff, oh my God.
It happened at 1:30 in the afternoon. You know, I mean, everybody's just doing their afternoon thing.
And it's like, even if you knew you had to get out of town, how would you?
How would you, yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm sure that, you know...
The reports from the people who are traveling to the region say that, you know, in the couple hundred miles before you get there, everything looks absolutely normal.
Hmm.
Except the gas stations are closed, the electricity's off.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it, you know, doesn't look bad until you get to where it's
bad. Mean, it wasn't even a huge ripple outside of, like, that little, well, not little, but it's a very large area. They're saying it's, like, you know, many, many miles of coastline got rippled up.
And we know at least, of I think, one or two people actually were killed here in the United States from the tsunamis hitting here.
Yeah, Yeah, I saw that guy got washed out to sea by the.
And he went to watch the tsunami. He thought it'd be fun to watch.
Oh boy.
Hey, hey, bud, pass me a brew, you know? I don't know. It's a scary world. And we've lost our Japanese audience for now, so.
Yeah, I would imagine.
So I guess we could say funny jokes about the Japanese, but I don't think it'd be very funny, actually.
Not funny at all. Not funny at all.
Yeah. All right, well, Greg is going to be there tomorrow night, and he'll have more notes for us for the April event, which we should all look forward to.
Oh, goody.
Death from Above 1979.
Death from Above 1979, someone I've never heard of that he is guaranteed a sellout for.
Yeah, well, if you look them up on Wiki, I think I sent a link to that originally, but go to Wiki and look them up.
Yeah.
They were pretty big. I mean, they sold 6 million copies of their record.
Holy mackerel.
So this is another thing that is so true, and it has to do with the size of the population that we have now.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it is literally possible for 6 million people to buy something and the rest of us 300 million have never heard of it.
Well, it's just like, you know, 40,000-50,000 people go to the Burning Man. It's been going on for 20 years, and in most circles when I bring it up, people have never heard of it.
Never heard of it, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And wow. And it's a cultural revolution, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's why I say that back in the, you know, I mean, I hate to refer to the day, but, you know, back in the late 60s or something, you really, if you wanted to know what was going on with the youth or the world, you needed to understand the music of the time.
Yeah.
That's why I say that today music's not significant anymore.
Well, the thing about music, though, too, is that there's so damn much of it.
Exactly.
You know, especially around the world, there's a ton more music than just what's produced here.
Well, that amazing thing, YouTube, you can, you know, there have to be just Chinese videos, Iranian videos,
Turkish,
you know, African videos,
yeah.
Egyptian videos.
Irish, French.
Irish videos,
German,
Scottish videos,
yeah.
Danish videos.
Slavic.
It's the entire world is posting stuff online.
Ukraine, yeah.
And again, I mean, there are gigantic stars in countries like the Philippines or Indonesia or Korea
uh-huh.
who are gigantic.
Uh-huh.
They're the biggest names in that world.
Uh-huh.
And they are complete unknown.
Have you ever heard of Robbie Williams?
There have been several different people called Robbie Williams.
Not our... Williams, you know, the comedian guy. That there's
Robin Williams. Yeah.
No, there's a pop star, and I think his name is Robbie Williams, and he is gigantically huge, and he has a house in Malibu, and a friend of mine did work at his house, and he's like a superstar. I mean, it's like he was Rod Stewart or something living there, and had girls around and everything. It's a huge mansion, and no one here's ever heard of him, and he's just
huge. Yeah, it is really a stunning thing. It also puts in perspective what stardom means, what that means, you know. I remember back in high school, I interviewed some rock bands that were doing a show in Peoria.
Uh-huh.
And one of them was William Oliver Swofford, who had a couple of hits under the name Oliver. He had, you know, Gene and Good Morning Starshine.
Okay.
And those were big hits
huge,
their time.
Iconic, yeah.
And the next day, my mom took her mom to the airport or something.
Uh-huh.
And so I mentioned, you know, I was so excited I'd met all these stars.
Uh-huh.
And she said, oh, I saw them at the airport. And they just sat there. And nobody was paying any attention to them at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And which would be commonplace and probably, you know, when you're traveling the world and stuff. I mean, I'm sure Mick Jagger gets, you know, mobbed anywhere
sure.
he goes. You know,
sure.
It's just because he's been around for so long and he's been around the world so many times, you know, so many different hits. But, you know, I mean, even like Lady Gaga could probably pass unannounced if she dressed normally.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Precisely, and yet even, you know, even big stars like John Lennon, say, he was able to wander around New York City and nobody'd bother him. Uh-huh. You know, because they're not impressed.
And
just
you were
because,
there at the time, yeah.
You know?
Now, I almost got hit by Buck Henry one time up in Mount Olympus. I had to squeeze against my car as he drove by on a narrow road there. And actually, I was riding my bicycle up Western many years ago, and I saw Stevie Wonder riding in the back of a brown limo, a brown Rolls.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I saw Charles Bronson drive by me a few times when I was visiting a friend who lives near where Bronson used to live in Malibu.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And he always waved.
Cool.
He always...
Yeah,
he had a little MG, you uh-huh. know, little sports car.
Uh-huh.
And he'd be driving back home, and everybody'd grin at him and wave, and he always waved at everybody, big smile.
Happy to be him, you know. It's all right. You know.
He's living on a $7 million mansion. You know.
Oh yeah.
He's handsome, happy.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Unlike
Charlie Sheen, who doesn't seem to be a happy man at all.
Yeah, but you know the thing that's weird about Charlie is he's the first figure in history who has had the internet available for him whenever he chooses.
That's true.
We've never had that before.
At his choice, really.
He can jump on Ustream, and there'll be a million people watching him in a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
And he'll just tweet that he's doing it, and he'll be there. Point. And it could happen at 4 a.m. or 3 p.m, anytime
mm-hmm.
he chooses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first time in history anybody's ever had that.
So. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But Justin Timberlake. Didn't he start revolutionizing the tweet world?
He could have, been. Yeah.
He's the first one to have a million friends or something.
And then I saw this very cute looking lesbian come on some show the other day, and she has a website, Lesbians Who Look Like Justin Bieber. And they all have the Bieber haircut.
Accidentally or on purpose?
I think it started accidentally, and then people started to notice it. Remember, Bieber changed his haircut a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I heard that, yeah. I think I saw a picture of him. Yeah, he finally got sick of it being in his eyes. I would have got sick of that right away.
All right, Johnny, well, you get back to the music and the good times.
Okay.
And if you got something to take with you, take my most recent show, Chill Room Proof Rock, which isn't posted yet, but it's a killer. It's one of the best shows I've ever done.
Is it in my? It's not in my email yet.
It's not in your email, but it's on the computer there. And if you've got something, you know, like a thumb drive or something to take things with you,
uh-huh.
it's in the shows folder.
Huh.
The most recent Chill Room. It's the uh-huh. near the top of the list.
Uh huh.
And, yeah, grab that out there and take a copy of it with you.
I can drop it into the player here, can't I?
It's probably in the player
actually,
right now.
Actually, I have taken to just leaving the player alone and just, like, hanging the stuff, my MP3s off the end and then erasing them so that I can leave that playlist, you know, so I don't have to build another one.
Okay, well, you can do that. I mean, my show should be on there, Chill Room Proof Rock.
I'll check it out.
Yeah. But anyway, I'll see you tomorrow evening. I'll talk to you tomorrow afternoon. Make sure.
Okay, meeting starts at 8. So
8 p.m., and so we'll try to be there at 7:30 or something.
Try and get together around 6:30, 7, yeah, something like
that. Yeah, and anybody who's listening, keep on listening to Kill Radio. This is the way radio is supposed to be. It's supposed to provide a service. It's supposed to get in your head, give you something to think about and something to listen to, and not just try to sell you shit.
Or just be wallpaper, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So, well, I like subversive wallpaper.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, like they have in Vegas with the velvet. Yeah, it's kind of nice.
All right, I'll talk to you later, Johnny.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, that was fun. Oh, it's always good to get a call in from the illustrious Bennett Thiessen, who has his own show, two shows on the Kill Radio here. Listen for them because they come up not only when he does them live, but they come up, you know, in the archives. But, here's a little something for you.
Hate New York City. It's cold and it's damp. And all the people dressed like monkeys. That Let's leave Chicago to the Eskimo. That town's a little bit too rugged for you and me, you bad girl. Rolling down Imperial Highway, the big nasty bed out of my side. Santa Ana winds blowing hot from the north. We were born to ride. Roll down the window, put down the top. Crank up the Beach Boys, baby. Don't let the music stop. We gonna ride it till we just can't ride it no more. From the side. Over there, man, he's down on his knees. Look at these women, ain't nothing like them nowhere. Century Boulevard,
we love it.
Victory Boulevard.
Last night,
in it with you. And everyone that I know, and everyone that you know was in my dream. I saw a vampire, I saw a ghost, everybody scared me, you scared me the most. Dream I had last night, the dream I had last night, in my dream.
For a minute, I just had to interject here. I read this article. It was a very powerful article in the LA Times. It is Saturday's Times. Okay, I'm behind the times, but still, I was reading this article. It says, starting on the front page, a wired planet sees the horror as it happens. Instead of bearing witness to a disaster's aftermath, viewers wait and watch in wrenching real time. After the quake, it took 45 minutes for the tsunami to reach the coast of Japan. 45 minutes of knowing, of waiting, of bracing. When it came, they were all glued to their televisions. A Jesuit priest in New York, an engineering professor in rural Oregon, a geophysicist in San Diego. What unfolded had never been broadcast live before. A 13-foot wall of mud that belittled human achievement, folding houses inside out, propelling yachts across miles of rice fields, rupturing oil refineries, sweeping trains from their tracks, and killing hundreds. By now, we're versed in bearing witness to the aftermath of disaster, limbs jutting out from collapsed buildings in Haiti, survivors using laundry to spell out "help us" on their rooftops after Hurricane Katrina. This was different. A disaster unfolding in visceral, wrenching, real time for viewers who were alternately spellbound and tortured by their inability to do anything about it. Japan's plight came on a sunny Friday afternoon. The magnitude 8.9 earthquake, the largest to strike the area in more than a millennium, hit at 2:46 p.m. local time. Japan is not only an advanced economy, but one of the most wired nations on Earth. At one point Friday, there were 20 tweets a second coming out of Tokyo. The nation, meanwhile, is on another page, is a voracious consumer of information, and media outlets and government officials have plenty of time after the quake to get their cameras in place, as well as estimates of where the waves would hit and when, which proved quite accurate. It was a confluence of events and circumstance that helped us watch, or forced us to watch, in a new way. When it was over, the images seemed to have bent both edges of the spectrum of comprehension. Scientists questioned the limits of science, and believers questioned the limits of faith. Deepak Chopra, the spirituality and wellness author, said he was surprised to find that his first thoughts as he watched the disaster unfold were of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Japanese cities leveled by American nuclear bombs at the end of World War II. Imagine, he thought, if Americans had watched those bombs explode on live television, would we be as tolerant as we are that we and many other countries are stockpiling nuclear weapons, he asked. We are living in a very interesting time, he said. What is emerging is that you cannot separate yourself emotionally or in any other way from what is happening anywhere in the world. We are a global community. We need to feel this pain. We need to act upon it. We need to realize that we are now entangled with everything that happens everywhere. Many said the only experience comparable to watching the tsunami was watching the destruction in Lower Manhattan on September 11, 2001. Indeed, some of the images on Friday cut close to the bone for Americans. In particular, the disturbing video of victims trapped in tall buildings, waving white shirts out of open windows in a desperate attempt to flag down rescuers, smoke curling around them. You are totally powerless against a memory like that, said J. John Bruno, the Episcopal Bishop of Los Angeles. It is embedded into your being. Ken Reeves, Director of Forecasting Operations at AccuWeather.com, was captivated and horrified watching video of cars trying to steer clear of the debris field with no high ground in sight. He watched a group of people standing on a bridge as rising, churning water sent boats lurching toward them. He said he couldn't help but think, "My God, get off the bridge!" For years now, Americans have reveled in an unlikely and incongruous notion on television, reality that is unreal. Said Father James Martin, a Jesuit priest in New York City and the culture editor of America, the weekly Catholic magazine. Here was something different, reality that was real. More gripping and terrible than anything even the most creative or cynical television producer could conjure. It's the shock of seeing real reality instead of fake reality. It seems paradoxically unreal, Martin said. A lot of these reality shows are based on watching people suffer. Watching them suffer physically, watching them suffer financially. It's important to recognize that we don't have to create suffering in this world. There is suffering in this world. Seafarers have long returned with tales, often dismissed as apocryphal, of the ocean abruptly reaching up and snatching at anything in its path. The 1883 explosion of the volcanic island Krakatoa unleashed waves that were estimated to have killed tens of thousands. Some argue that there's even descriptions of tsunamis in the Bible, Reeves said. These events, though, are extremely rare and occur only in low-lying areas with the requisite mix of geophysical conditions. The 2004 tsunami event in the Indian Ocean, which killed 230,000 people in 14 nations, marked a dramatic turning point in awareness of the potential for titanic waves, in part because it was captured on cell phone videos and other devices, though nothing approaching this level of documentation. That episode also prodded many scientists to ratchet up their efforts to understand tsunamis and communicate their danger. But that science is still very much in its infancy, so much so that researchers in the northwestern United States and British Columbia, another area thought prone to tsunamis, still rely in part on Native American word-of-mouth legend to understand the physics of past events here. You're talking about things that can occur 300 years apart, said Dr. Frank Vernon, a research geophysicist at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in San Diego. Vernon said that as he watched the tsunami come ashore, he was unable to divorce the scientist in him from the humanist. You want to reach out and help, and you can't do anything except maybe better prepare for the next round, he said. Indeed, scientists hope to seize on images of the tsunami to dramatically increase their understanding. Currently, scientists are able to predict landfall, but only after a tsunami has begun offshore and typically by using a relatively rudimentary system of buoys that measure fluctuations in wave levels. They know far less about how tsunamis are created, or why some offshore earthquakes create them and some don't, or how the waves will react once they reach land. No tsunami has ever been documented to this degree. Harry Yeh, a professor of engineering at Oregon State University, was watching a cooking show with his wife on Japanese language television when the live news reports broke into the broadcast. His heart broke for his native Japan, he said, but he instantly recognized that within the small, tight-knit community of scientists who studied tsunamis, this was extremely intriguing and amazing. Still, the scope of the disaster is a reminder of how much work lies ahead. It's going to be hundreds of years before we get enough of a record, Vernon said. Indeed, the limits of science were at least as evident as the potential advances. The hubris of humanity makes us forget how powerful nature can be, said Bill Patzert, a climatologist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in La Cañada, Flint Ridge. He said, this was not an act of God. But then he paused and added, well, I hope not. I could be wrong. An agnostic. Theologians were left with ambiguities of their own. Martin, the Jesuit priest, said that the non-believers may well have an easier time digesting the disturbing images from Japan than believers, because the non-believer does not have to grapple with, how does a good God let this happen? Most people can make sense of what theologians call moral evil, evil that comes from human decisions, he said, but natural disasters and catastrophic illnesses really test the believer's faith. There is no satisfactory answer for why there is such suffering in the world on a natural level. Some faiths, Christianity in particular, are imbued with the notion that God is not impersonal and accompanies humans in their suffering, Martin said, but no explanation can fully satisfy that question of why we suffer. He said, and anyone who says they have the answer is either a fool or a liar. To leave you on that philosophical note. Thank you. That was really good. That was The Residents doing Consuelo's Departure, which unfortunately is my departure. I'm going to end the show here. I've been going on for about 2 hours, so I'm probably bored you long enough. Just to go back on my playlist there, I did I Love L.A. by Randy Newman. Also, Last Night I Had a Dream, also by Randy Newman, and You Can Leave Your Hat On. Then I read that little article, and then Powerhouse by Raymond Scott, and wound up the set with Consuelo's Departure by The Residents. Hope you enjoyed the show today. Stay tuned for next week. I intend to be here at 3 p.m. Maybe I'll even make it on time. But I was a little held up today because Brad the Impaler, Brad the the bicycle guy was having computer issues. But anyway, so I'm going to end the show here, and goodbye. Is it going to do that? All right, wait, here, I got to be there. All right, there, bye.